This presentation has been previously broadcast.
The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show.
On Relevant Radio.
So I'm here to talk about two things. First, the steps we're going to take immediately. And second, the action that needs to be taken going forward to curb the epidemic of gun violence. I asked the Attorney General and his team to identify for me immediate, concrete actions I could take now without having to go through the Congress. And today I'm announcing several initial steps my administration is taking to curb this epidemic of gun violence. Much more need be done, but the first.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
That, of course, was the president. Coming up a little later, we'll talk about what he's planning to do regarding guns and your Second Amendment. We'll break that down. Right now, if you're joining me, though, we are taking a look at COVID-19 and all the latest. There was a lot of talk about a COVID-19 passport and that you might have to have that. And I'm not just talking about traveling internationally. It might be something that's used in the state. And I was sharing a little bit earlier that the state of New York is doing that. You know, you'll have a mobile app on your phone. And if you're vaccinated, you get a beautiful, nice, fat green check. If you're not, a big, ugly red X, right? I was reading an article over the weekend, and somebody was making the case that these vaccine passports are almost a new purity test. And the person made the argument that the Biden administration, you know, they were looking into establishing a vaccine passport system. They've recently came back. The press secretary says, oh, we're not going to do that. We're concerned about privacy. But just to give you a look at what happens overseas, in Israel, vaccine certificates are already required to enter a lot of public places. You know, so if you're concerned, you know, as my guest had pointed out, we could become a two-tiered society, you know, the haves and the haves not, the vaccinated and the unvaccinated. You know, you could see an ostracization between people who chose not to get the vaccine and those who do. The public narrative is not only, you know, building prejudice against people who refuse to get the vaccine. In some respects, you know, it's blaming the spread of the virus on asymptomatically infected people. They're saying you might not know you have it. Get the vaccine. We need to know whether you have it. So if they roll out vaccine certificates, you know, you could be stepping firmly into some very discriminatory territory. And this person in this particular article I read over the weekend, they said, look, you know what? This could lead to persecution of non-vaccinated individuals, you know, and are they going too far? They said, you know, at that point, if we get to this point where you choose not to get the vaccine for some reason, you know, we'll have replicated the Nazis regime of the four-step process of dehumanizing the Jews, which ultimately allowed genocide to occur. And he made the case, he said, vaccine passports are about creating justification for segregation, discrimination, and then the elimination of certain groups of people in the cases of people who don't want to be part of you know, society by being compliant and getting their vaccinations. Maybe that's a little extreme. I don't know. I'm just throwing it out. There was a lot of concern. As I pointed out, though, the White House has backed down on that. And I don't think you're going to have vaccine passports being the new test. And Governor Abbott and others have said, hey, there's no way that's going to happen in my state, as you heard. My guest today wrote an article. He actually wrote it for the Wall Street Journal. We linked over to it on Twitter at Drew Mariani Show. Dr. Jay Bhattacharya joins us today. And, Doctor, what's the headline of your article as well, if you want to get people plugged in? You address this issue, don't you?
Lay out my thoughts about the vaccine passports. It says vaccine passports prolong lockdowns.
Wow.
The title of the article.
And why do they prolong the lockdown?
Well, I mean, if you think about what the vaccine passports do, is they're going to create this disincentive in some ways actually get vaccinated. It'll entrench people's a subset of people, not everybody, people who don't want to get vaccinated. They'll say, well, why are they forcing me to get vaccinated? It'll create this it'll also create this like demand for continuing lockdown. So why have if you're not locked down, well, why have a vaccine passport? Like I can go on an airplane now. I don't need a passport. It sort of creates this like a continuing state of crisis and entrenches it in a sense.
Right. Mary is listening in Maine. She wants to join the conversation. Hi, Mary. You're on the air with Dr. Bhattacharya.
Thank you so much for having me. And everything so far that you've said has been valid. But my real concern is who's going to manage? It's very clear that the White House is signaling that they're not going to manage passports. They're going to hand this off to high-tech, big tech. And we've seen what they've done with Facebook and Twitter. They're going to be managing all of our medical data and our information. Their sovereignty is going to be beyond the United States border, managing people coming in, managing people going out. And that, to me, is really frightening. I think these passports are really dangerous for that reason, and I'd love to hear what the doctor has to say about it.
All right, Mary, thanks.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for that. I mean, I think that I think it's true that private entities need to be very, very careful with health data, and you have a right to health privacy. It's enshrined in the law that you have a right to health privacy, that the private entities that have the health data should have a right to it, like, for instance, your medical providers, and that should be using it for your good. I don't know of any safeguards around that the vaccine passports that have been considered that make me confident that they would see to that privacy rights that you have. I think this is just a very poorly thought out idea, and I'm glad to see the Biden administration back down from it.
Yeah, me too. Teresa is listening in Walnut Creek, California. Teresa, hi. You're on the air with Dr. Bhattacharya.
Hi, thanks. I had a couple of comments and a question also. I'll ask the question first, and then I'll make my comments. The question is, do you know what type of passport? Would it be paper or electronic? Because essentially, in China, they did the exact same thing in 2019. I was reading an article way back when, and the picture in the article looked exactly like the card that you get when you have the vaccine, you know, your two dates of vaccinations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it was managed, the plan was to manage a central database by the DOJ or the CDC, and that is very frightening. It's essentially microchipping us if we have an app on our phone to avoid, having to carry around a card or whatever. And the article I read had a great big red check and a great big red X and a great big green check mark. So it also discriminates against the poor and those who don't speak English, the illegals who are trying to fly under the radar. Yeah. I mean, it's really broad brush.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it would be like New York State, for instance, has cooperated, I think, with IBM, and it would be an electronic passport. I mean, there's no really other way to, you'd need some centralized database. So, I think it would be electronic.
Yeah, but I don't think it's going to happen. Do you, Doctor, or do you think you'll see something like this? Even the ACLU had a problem with it.
I mean, I think if you'd asked me a week ago, I would have said it might happen. I mean, New York, I think, for instance, as I said, it stops it, and as Israel and China, of course. But I think now there's been a pushback, enough pushback that we're seeing, the folks who are in favor of it start to retreat, and which is a really good thing. I mean, we should be expressing, regular people should be expressing their thoughts about this. This is not just something for experts to weigh in on. This is something that's going to affect every single person's life. Everyone has the right to make their opinion known about what they are willing to accept for this country. And I'm glad to see that regular people are pushing back.
Yeah. What do you make of the resistance? I saw an article. This was in the New York Times. It said nearly half of evangelicals resist vaccines. And I'll just share a couple sentences from this. It says, quote, many high-profile conservative pastors and institutional leaders have endorsed the vaccines. Franklin Graham told his 9.6 million Facebook followers that Jesus would advocate for vaccination. Pastor Robert Jeffress commended it from an anti-abortion perspective on Fox News. He says, we talk about life in the womb being a gift from God. Well, life outside the womb is a gift from God, too. The president of the Southern Baptist Convention, J.D. Greer, he tweeted a photo of himself receiving the shot. Of course, you know, we know Pope Francis has also suggested people get this as well. Are we seeing a breakdown, you know, in the culture by conservatives, by evangelicals? I mean, what is it that's making some people say, yes, I want to be open and get this, and others, no, I don't want it? Is it the science? It's the fact that it's a new type of vaccination? People are waiting to see how it all shakes out. I mean, what are your thoughts on how divided this nation, and really this, well, yeah, the people are on the issue? So many people
I mean,
are.
It's actually remarkable to me. I mean, I thought the vaccine itself is in some ways an amazing achievement that was produced so quickly, and you know, for people who are older, it is really a godsend. I mean, it protects you against this absolutely deadly disease, and the risk of the side effects are quite low. And you know, for people of faith who are troubled by the use of these immortal cell lines derived from embryos for the AstraZeneca vaccine, well, there's other vaccines that you can use that didn't rely on the technology. I mean, so in that sense, it's completely consistent, I think, with people's faith. I'm glad to see that many religious leaders are arguing in favor. Now, you asked why people are distrustful. I mean, the public health bureaucracy has done an incredibly poor job in generating trust for itself through this epidemic. They keep pushing interventions that have not worked to stop the spread of the disease. Lockdowns, for instance, have not done a very good job communicating what really is likely to work and what's not unlikely to work. They've demonized. That's like such a situation where people demonize people with COVID. They look at them as if they were their failures, as opposed to treating them with compassion because they have a disease that needs to be treated.
Yeah, it's a great point. My wife said the same thing, doctor, the other day. I mean, if you happen to get COVID, it's like you did something wrong. You know, it's like it's not your fault. You know, you don't know how you're exposed to it or not.
Jesus went to see the lepers. Like that was one of the big revolutions that Jesus instituted, is by breaking down the barriers between the sick and the sick are not the outcasts of Jesus. The sick are people that need our love, our touch. I mean, same thing should be true for COVID patients.
Well, during the bubonic plague, I mean, it was the Christians that went to the streets and helped these people and brought about great conversion. You know, I was talking yesterday. I saw a report that the CDC, I think they said this actually yesterday, that the idea that you can get COVID-19 from touching a surface is highly unlikely. I mean, the chance is like 1 in 10,000. And back to your point about lockdowns right now being impractical, I'm concerned about the future of academics in this country. I mean, I think we've lost a whole year of good education for a lot of students. Do you think schools should be back opened? Lockdowns should not take place. And the fact that we didn't know much about COVID-19 when it first came out, you weren't sure whether you'd get it off the cardboard box from Amazon, right? Now we know, 1 in 10,000. So how does this new data factor into what we'll see in the not too distant future?
Well, I hope it helps contribute to keeping opening the schools immediately, right? A lot of the constraints that people have said, well, we have to do all this cleaning, we have to do plastic barriers. None of that works to actually slow the spread of the disease, it turns out, and we don't need any of it. I think we should open schools immediately. In Florida, they're open. 100% of students are 5-day in person. In Nebraska, in a whole suite of states, they're open. It's just places like California where we basically robbed our children of a year of education for not much gain for public health.
I feel self-indulgent here. I know there's some people who want to join you, and I know you've got to go in a minute, but I was reading some side effects from those who've actually had COVID-19. There is a side effect called cognitive dulling, where you know, those who've had COVID-19, they find that they have mental fatigue or they have what they call brain fog. I saw another story that 1 in 3 COVID patients, those who've had it, have a neuropsychiatric illness in 6 months after the infection. And that should be a big red flag for somebody who has not had it or maybe who has had it. 6 months after being diagnosed, they made the case that 1 in 3 patients had experienced a psychiatric or a neurological illness. They were mostly mood disorders, but also strokes and dementia. And it was a pretty large new study. And that might make a case for, you know, hey, get vaccinated so you don't have to go through this. So I know some people are concerned about vaccinations and the side effects, but I think the side effects from COVID might be even worse. But your thoughts on some of those things that are coming out regarding the strange side effects of COVID?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something we're going to learn about over time. The best study I've seen actually suggests that it's much lower, the rate at which people get these long-term, like fatigue, for instance. It's like at about 12 weeks, it's about 2% still have symptoms like that, is the best study in the literature I've read. A lot of the difficulty in tracking this is, you know, the lockdowns themselves induce depression. So tracking and distinguishing the effects of COVID from the effects of the lockdown is a challenging sort of scientific task, and we'll see, I think, as days pass. But I completely agree with you that if you're concerned about this, get the vaccine, and that basically reduces the risk to you know, very small levels.
Hey, doctor, thank you for your time. I really am grateful for so much of it. A great conversation. I wish we had a little bit more of it. We'll bring you back to talk about it. It seems that every week there's a new development when it comes to COVID-19. It's something that everyone needs to know. So keep up your great work. Keep writing, too. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. It's Dr. Jay Bhattacharya. We posted his Wall Street Journal article on Twitter. So if you go to @DrewMarianiShow, you will find it. In a moment, we're going to be joined by Dave Koppel. He's going to be stopping by. And the president today signed an executive order that targets some gun control measures. And I know this is a hot button for a lot of people. What is the White House doing? Again, this president, I never saw anyone who's written more executive orders. And I'll tell you how this will impact you, and does it at all threaten your Second Amendment? We'll look at that and more right after this.
This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. Stay with us.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
The Drew Mariani Show. The issues that matter most right here on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, it's great to be with you. We're in the moment right now bringing you the latest on the president who signed another executive order that targets some gun control measures. The White House released a fact sheet, and it was entitled, I find this striking too. We can talk about this too. Yes, normally the Trump administration, the Obama administration, the Clinton administration, they have rephrased or recoined this administration. You'll find that their fact sheets and everything you put up is the Biden-Harris administration. So the fact sheet says Biden-Harris administration announces initial actions to address the gun violence public health epidemic. There's been a lot of talk about this, as you probably know, and there are 6 points that this order touches on. So-called ghost guns, guns made from kits that don't have serial numbers on them so they can't be traced, pistols that have stabilizing braces on them so they're more accurate, and model legislation for so-called red flag laws that states could pick up on, more funding for community violence prevention programs, and the Justice Department's also going to issue an annual report on firearms tracking. Here's what the president said in his address. And as I mentioned, the topic ghost gun, that's one of his first steps, is to tackle those so-called weapons. Listen.
Want to rein in the proliferation of so-called ghost guns. These are guns that are homemade, built from a kit, and include directions on how to finish the firearm. You can go buy the kit. They have no serial numbers. So when they show up at a crime scene, they can't be traced. And the buyers aren't required to pass a background check to buy the kit, to make the gun. Consequently, anyone from a criminal to a terrorist can buy this kit in as little as 30 minutes, put together a weapon. You know, I want to see these kits treated as firearms under the Gun Control Act, which is going to require that the seller and manufacturers make the key parts with serial numbers and run background checks on the buyers when they walk in to buy that package.
All right. So that's the situation on the ghost guns. You may agree with him. President Biden went on to tell you a little bit about the second action that will be taken against guns, and here it is.
The second action we're going to take, back in the year 2000, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms released a report on its investigations of firearms trafficking in America. The report was of pivotal value. It was an important tool for policymakers when I was in the Senate and beyond, at all levels, to stop firearms from being illegally diverted into dangerous hands. Today, with online sales and ghost guns, times and trafficking methods have changed, and we have to adjust. We also have to ask the Justice Department to release a new annual report. This report will better help policymakers address firearms trafficking as it is today, not what it was yesterday.
All right, some of what the president had to say. We can share more with you coming up in a moment. Yeah, one final thought here, and I want to go to Mr. Koppel, who's going to be stopping by. The president stated that, look, none of these proposals that he's putting forward has anything, it will not in any way violate the Second Amendment. And here's what he said, and I want to quote him. He said, quote, no amendment to the Constitution is absolute. You can't yell fire in a crowded movie theater and call it freedom of speech. From the very beginning, you couldn't own any weapon you wanted to own. From the very beginning of the Second Amendment existed, certain people weren't allowed to have weapons. So he announced today, he nominated David Chipman as the head of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. And that nomination is probably what most alarms people who are strong supporters of the Second Amendment, Second Amendment advocates, because he's been characterized as an anti-gun, or as a gun grabber is what I should say. And, of course, there's still legislation that the House passed and is in the Senate that could seriously curtail the rights of gun owners. So I've invited David Koppel. He's a research director of the Independence Institute in Denver to join us today to give us some perspective. He's an associate policy analyst also with the Cato Institute in Washington. And he's been with us in the past. We've talked about his book, The Morality of Self-Defense and Military Action, the Judeo-Christian Tradition. I would suggest you follow him on Twitter at Dave Koppel. That's K-O-P-E-L. You can also follow his website, davekoppel.org. It's good to have you back, Dave. Thank you for your time and especially for your patience today.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having me.
Well, a lot to talk about today. The president has come out and said, hey, look, here's what I'm proposing. This is what I want to do. He's got his executive pen all ready to sign. And he says these rules, they will not impinge on Second Amendment rights. Let's pick up on that last statement that I shared of his. I mean, do you agree with that? And maybe you can parse that out for us a little bit.
Oh, it's hard to say yet because the rules haven't been written. You know, he calls the executive order was simply telling the Department of Justice to write some regulations on particular topics. And, you know, how can you know if the regulations violate the Constitution or not until they're written? So we'll have to see on that.
Yeah. So the ghost guns was a big issue. And, you know, I think there are some people who might say, well, it kind of makes sense what he's saying. Why shouldn't these guns have a serial number? Why shouldn't they be checked? Why shouldn't people who buy them, why shouldn't they treat these weapons just like you treat another firearm? Explain what a ghost gun is, why it's so important for law enforcement to have serial numbers on weapons. Maybe explain that. And I don't know where you stand on the whole issue of ghost gun, but let me know.
It's not important because when you, by law, when a manufacturer makes a gun, they put a serial number on the operable part of the gun, the part of the gun that does the loading, the shooting, the unloading. That's called the receiver. And then when the there's a paperwork trail that goes on that from the manufacturer to the wholesaler to the retailer, and then, of course, identifying the person who buys the gun in the store. And then you find a gun that's used by a criminal, you know, maybe recovered from a criminal who's caught in the middle of robbing a liquor store. You know, you don't find like, oh, I bought the gun yesterday at the gun store and I'm holding up the liquor store on the weekend. The gun was stolen, most likely, from the lawful buyer. And, you know, then at that point it becomes untraceable in that path from the theft to where it's recovered from a criminal. So it's quite rare that serial numbers accomplish much in the solution of crimes. But here's the thing. It's always been the law in the United States that if you want to make your own firearm at home for your own personal use, that's fine, and you don't need a manufacturing license to do that. On the other hand, if you make guns and you give them away to your friends or you sell guns, then you do have to get a manufacturing license from the federal government. What Biden wants to do is say, even if you're making a gun for yourself at home, which has always been lawful, we're going to have extra restrictions on it. And I think one of the real complications for people is, let's say, you know, you have a gun, you've got a handgun, and you use it for target shooting, and, you know, maybe you're a competitive shooter, you use it a lot. You know, after a while, the barrel starts to wear out. And so you buy a new barrel. Right now, that's fine. No big deal, because what's considered the firearm for federal law is that receiver. that central component of the gun that makes it work. So if you buy new grips, a scope, a barrel, a new trigger, all those things, they're not serialized, and you don't have to go through the process of buying them at a gun store and being treated as if you were buying a new gun, because you're not. You're just buying a replacement part for something on your old gun that's worn out. Biden wants to massively increase the difficulty of people being able to actually, fix and repair their own guns.
So what's the agenda behind that? I mean, why is he so anti-gun? Does he really believe that, and these mass shootings are horrible. They quite often use those situations that seem to come up way too frequently as a means to try to get guns off the streets. What's the ideology, or what's the end goal behind the administration for doing this?
Well, these so-called ghost guns appear, quite rarely in crimes. I mean, not zero, but it's a very small percentage compared to, normal commercial firearms that were, made by a big manufacturer, then sold lawfully, and then at some point stolen in a burglary. It's hard to say what Biden's agenda is. I think we can say with some confidence what Michael Bloomberg's agenda is, and mm-hmm. he's the mastermind behind this whole thing. He's the one who pays for all the grassroots, puts huge amounts of money into the Democratic Party, and they're, understandably feel very beholden to their rich uncle money bags. He's trying to make sure that every gun is in some kind of database, so that guns can be confiscated, and he's supported confiscation measures in the past as mayor of New York City, confiscated guns and used registration lists to do so. So, maybe your old rifle you got from grandpa 40 years ago isn't in some federal database, but under the Biden plan, you buy a replacement barrel for that. You and the barrel, and then implicitly the gun it fits, are going to be in the federal database, and that makes future confiscation a lot easier.
Wow.
And as I said, Michael Bloomberg is a gun confiscator. He did it in New York City, and he's building the where all guns had to be registered ever since mm-hmm. 1967, and he's building the foundation for that in the future nationally.
All right, my guest today, Dave Kopel. If you want to join us, let me give you the number. You can get in at 888-914-9149. We're taking a look at Joe Biden, President Biden's gun control executive order, and what it means for the country and the future of guns in this nation. Frank is listening in California. He wants to join the conversation, too. Frank, hi. You're on the air with Dave Kopel.
For Obama, they lost all those guns under Operation Fast and Furious. And a lot of us are having an emotional reaction with his executive orders, but how would this play out if it's challenged in the Supreme Court? Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right. Did you? I don't know if you made all that out, David. He's questioning how this will be challenged in the Supreme Court.
I didn't quite hear it all, but first of all, challenged in the Supreme Court is that's up to the Supreme Court, and they have in the last several years not been very interested in taking gun cases at all, or at least Second Amendment cases. And secondly, we don't know what particular regulations are going to be written. And there are a lot of things that are bad ideas that are not unconstitutional. So I'd say it's premature to expect anything to talk about what the courts might do.
Right. Let me share a piece of audio with you, and then we'll go back. We'll grab a few more calls. Again, 888-914-9149. There is a gun rights advocate by the name of Colin, I think it's Colion Noir. I had seen a soundbite of him a little bit earlier today. Very articulate. He's an attorney, a strong gun rights advocate. He was on, I think, Fox and Friends this morning, and he made the case. He shared why he disagrees with these actions that the Biden administration wants to take. And let me just play for you what he thinks and what his case is.
So for me, this doesn't do anything to keep me safe or anybody else safe who's a gun owner out here in this country. But they understand that. But as it goes, and I say time and time again, the ultimate goal is to gain control utilizing these measures, not necessarily to keep people safe, because these measures don't do anything to keep anybody safe.
The way you attack a problem, I always thought, was look what the problem is, examine if there's any consistencies, and see if there's something you could do legislatively. So, for example, look at the last 10 shootings. Look at the last 2 shootings. Is there any consistency there? As a gun owner, you could see, hey, let's work together to solve this so the lunatics don't get guns. What do you see? What do you think? Why didn't they do this?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if they actually did do this and study this and then came to a conclusion and realized this doesn't fit our agenda. Because anybody who sees these shootings can immediately testify to the fact that the vast majority of these mass shootings happen in gun-free zones. And then a vast majority of these shooters got their guns legally. So what piece of legislation or law are you going to create to stop these types of things, except to put the people, the good people with firearms, in a position to better and easily protect themselves when stuff like this does happen, like getting rid of gun-free zones? But they never entertain that thought. Everything they do with respect to the gun control issue is based around how do you further restrict the right, making it harder for good people. It's always a punishment for the good people, never anything that's actually designed to empower the good people to fight against bad people.
So I love your take on that particular point. You know, again, gun-free zones, a lot of these shootings take place. Most people who commit these heinous acts, they buy the guns, you know, legally. They go through that. You heard his comments. Your thoughts?
I think there's some truth to that. I remember there was at a church in Texas a little while ago, some guy started a mass shooting and was quickly shot by one of the parishioners who stopped the mass murder and saved a lot of lives. And Michael Bloomberg came out and said that was a bad idea. You know, that's too dangerous to have people shooting back at criminals. That's not his job. Only the government should be able to, in essence, only the government and not individuals should be able to shoot a violent criminal who's trying to murder a lot of people. You know, and so in Bloomberg's theory, it's a more orderly society when all the people in the church are dead, and because only the government should have been able to shoot them, and there didn't happen to be police officers nearby.
So this guy went on. He made another interesting point that it stood out to me. He talked about AR-15s. I think he made the case that less than 1% of most of these shootings are done with the AR-15s, and they're falsely classified. Let me play part of this audio here. He brought up stats on AR-15 and ghost guns. And again, we know that Joe Biden is trying to get serial numbers put onto those. Here again is Colleon Noir.
I honestly think that the whole ghost gun issue is a red herring. All it is designed to scare the public who really doesn't truly understand this issue at a finite level and get them to agree with anything they say. Because if we think about it, the vast majority of criminals get their guns illegally on the black market anyway, or they're stealing their guns. So why are we even having this conversation when it doesn't do anything to actually, once again, make people safer? Why are we even talking about this, to be honest with you, with respect to the Biden administration? Less than 1% of gun deaths in this country are a result of AR-15s, which they falsely classify as assault weapons. But I can demonstrate and show you tons of cases where people have used AR-15s to protect themselves. So why are we even having this conversation? And if the goal was really, if it's really about you getting rid of the gun that causes the most damage, if they were being genuine about it, we'd be talking about handguns, because over 80% of gun deaths in this country are committed by way of handguns. So it's not about what gun does what. Let's get to the root cause of these issues and deal with them. But it's a lot easier to just say, you know what, let's just punish the good people and restrict people's rights with legislation, because God forbid they actually roll their sleeves up and do the hard work necessary to actually deal with the underlying issues with respect to gun violence in this country.
So I think there's two great points. The final one is, what is the core problem here? I mean, why are we seeing this, and how can we focus our attention to get to that? And then the other point you brought up was about 80% of most of the acts of gun violence are done with handguns. Are handguns, Dave, in the crosshairs of the Biden administration next? So give me your take on that. And then secondly, how do we get, as to what he pointed out, to the root cause of this? I mean, it sounds nice saying that, but boy, how do you solve that problem?
Well, there's no one root cause. You know, people become criminals in different kinds of ways. Certainly for mass shootings, mental illness is a major factor, for a lot of the criminals who do that. Not all of them, but quite disproportionately compared to crime in general. So we could get at the root cause of that by raising taxes or reallocating spending to provide better mental health care. You know, we're right now in a society, the number of inpatient mental health beds we have for treating people on a per capita basis, we're at the same level we were in the 1850s. You know, and we're a much more prosperous society than then, so we ought to be able to afford treatment for at the very least, as a starting point, treatment for people who want it. You have people, including one of my friends from grade school, who can tell they're having a problem. They're decompressing in the psychological term of art, and walk into a mental health facility and say, I need to check in. And the admitting nurse looks at him and says, honey, you're not admitting material, which might have been true yet because they had such limited capacity. But it was going to be, you know, she was back in the hospital a couple of weeks later, having deteriorated enough that she needed had to be treated mm-hmm. in person. Right. So if we just, as a starting point, we ought to be able to agree, let's expand treatment capacity enough for people who want inpatient treatment voluntarily. That doesn't take away anybody's rights. In fact, it expands them because people who can seek treatment and get it can then exercise all of their human rights in a better and more responsible and more, you know, realistic way.
All right. William's listening in Bloomington, Indiana. William, hi. You're on the air with Dave Koppel. Good afternoon.
Hey. Thank you so much for having me. Good afternoon to you, too. I was enjoying the conversation, and I guess one of the questions I had, which your guest just addressed, was what are affirmative things? I think it's so easy when we look at these big policies to kind of counterpunch, right? When somebody puts out an idea, then we just go after it and hit it, and we throw darts at it, and we criticize it. Sometimes we even criticize the people who maybe are trying to do the right thing, right? We call them fat money bags, and we have all of these terms that we use that capture some sort of cultural angle to it. But I'm wondering just the guest that you have, I was enjoying listening to until he called Blumenthal some names, and then I sort of backed up because I said, oh, wait a minute, now this doesn't belong in this conversation. And so I was wondering just how much of this is cultural and how much of this is actually trying to solve a problem.
Yeah, all right, William, first of all, thanks for listening. Great comment. I'm glad you stay tuned. And Dave, I'll let you respond to that.
I think the caller makes some good points, and I'd agree with it in an even broader way that a lot of this is very much a cultural debate, more so than a gun control debate. You know, the particular issues that we're talking about in gun control, which is an issue I've been writing and working on since the mid-1980s, you know, they're sort of a flavor of the month thing, and they come and go, and some of them come back. But there's always something the people who don't like guns are working on to do, and often misleading the public about it. And the root cultural conflict is there are some people who think, you know, not only do I want to be able to own a gun for you know, going hunting a few days a year or for being a target competitor or something like that, I want to own a gun to protect myself and my family and, you know, in the worst possible case, like some kind of breakdown of civil order like we've sometimes seen, my family and my community. And there's other people who say, no, that is just a very backwards way of thinking. That's like caveman, barbarian. It's very atavistic. In a properly ordered society, the wise people at the top make the right decisions for the people underneath them, you know, as in some kind of benevolent absolute monarchy.
Right.
And that's part of the United States versus Europe divide. Is in the United States, the sovereignty is very expressly mm-hmm. in the people. Right. And in Europe, it's more like, no, we're the elites. You know, we're the anarchs, as they call them in France, mm-hmm. For the university they go to. We'll make wise decisions on your behalf for you, and that is the root cultural dispute in this, and guns get fought over because they're very symbolic for both sides about this kind of view of a top-down versus more of a bottom-up society.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I have to take a short pause. When we come back, we'll take a few more calls. William, again, thanks for your call. Would the country be a safer place if there were no guns on the street? Let's look at that, too, when I return. Stay with me.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Get all the news and issues of the day. News and issues of the day. Right now.
Right now.
This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, thanks for joining me. If you are just getting tuned in, let me bring you up to speed on the latest. The president today signed an executive order that targets some gun control measures. He laid out a number of different points and addressed the nation. I've invited Dave Koppel to stop by today and to give us some perspective on this. He authored a book called The Morality of Self-Defense and Military Action, the Judeo-Christian Tradition. And, of course, I shared with you in the past, he's been a regular here. He's a policy analyst at the Cato Institute, a research director of independence, of the Independence Institute in Denver. And you can follow him at Dave Koppel or at his website, davekoppel.com. That's K-O-P-E-L. Dave, we'll go back to the phones. Before I do, I just threw out this question that you often hear as the gun issue comes up in the Second Amendment. We live in a different time. You know, I know we need a well-regulated militia. That's what our founding fathers initially said. But look, your handgun, your AR-15 is not going to do anything against a tank or the technology, the drones that the U.S. has now. So has the Second Amendment kind of run its course? And then part two is, if we didn't have guns, handguns, if the citizenry didn't have them, would the nation be a safer place? Would people still be going in and, you know, robbing stores with these weapons? Would we see mass shootings and things along those lines? There are some who argue you might see some of that, but overall, that would diminish dramatically. So how do you address those two issues?
Well, I'd say on the no guns theory, there's I think there's a valid starting point to it. You know, when we think about mass murders that are perpetrated, it's easier to do it with a gun than with other means. I mean, it doesn't have to be with a gun. You know, Timothy McVeigh and his accomplices murdered a lot of people using bombs. But McVeigh was also trained in how to make bombs by the United States Army when he was in the military. And, you know, the average person who makes a bomb can't do it with that level of skill. At Columbine, the criminals had a number of bombs that they had set and attempted to detonate, and they injured some people, but they didn't kill anybody with their homemade bombs. But they did kill people with good quality, you know, just over-the-counter commercial firearms.
Right.
And it's also true in other contexts. I mean, imagine some kind of scrawny 17 or 23-year-old guy who's trying to hold up a liquor store, you know, and then there's two burly guys behind the counter. If the criminal has a gun, then he's got deadly force that he can threaten against the people in the liquor store. Right. And if he only has a contact weapon like a knife or a baseball bat or something like that, he doesn't gain as much of an advantage. The problem is those very capabilities that make guns more useful than other common things for offense are also exactly what makes them useful for defense. You know, the ability to project force at a distance. You know, when three thugs break into grandma's house in a neighborhood on the rough side of town, she's not going to be able to handle them with judo or a knife or something like that. But with a handgun, she can keep them at a distance and realistically have that threat of force to defend herself. So I think the anti-gun, the gun ban point is valid, but you've got to consider both sides of that.
What about the Second Amendment now in terms of a well-regulated militia defending ourselves against a tyrannical government?
Well, I think what we've seen around the world, and not just in the in the 1700s when the Second Amendment was written, but very much true in the 20th century, is that even though, you know, things like tanks and artillery and all that have improved a lot on the side of the hypothetical tyrannical government, the tyrants are terrified of ordinary arms possession by ordinary citizens. Every place that does genocide, you know, mass murder of the public, always works very hard to disarm the victims first. And that was true in Hitler when, you know, in Hitler's days when, you know, like in the against the Dutch and the Jews in the Netherlands, you know, he wasn't worried that the Jews were going to rise up and drive the Panzer tanks out of the Netherlands. But if you got somebody who can shoot the secret policeman when he comes to take you away and put you in on the train to the extermination camp, that makes work a lot harder for the secret police.
Yeah.
You know, Ronald Reagan said exactly that. Every time you have a communist or a fascist or other type of regime that wants to perpetrate mass murder, they always try to disarm the victims first.
That's true.
So that tells me that the fact that all the mass murderers insist on having disarmed victims first tells you that they view victim armament as a pretty serious threat. Not necessarily to overthrow their regime, but to significantly cause problems for mass murder.
Yeah. Right, let me grab a call or two before we run out of time here, too. Lucretia is listening in San Bruno, California. Hi, Lucretia. You're on the air.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call. I'm sorry. I am asking myself this question. Okay, the politicians, they have the right to have security bodyguards to go wherever they go to defend them and to defend their families. Why is it that we don't have the right to have a gun to defend ourselves and defend our families? This happened in Venezuela. That when the government in the 2000s, some months that in 1999 something, when the communist government came in, they took all the firearms from the people. Then when the people realized that that one was a communist government, Marxist communist government, they couldn't defend themselves from the army. And then they did atrocities to the people there. And no, I think if the politicians that don't have any bodyguards, no one taking care of them, they don't have any
power. Hey, Lucretia, thank you. I'm just going to hold you on that thought because your phone's breaking up a little bit on us here. But, Dave, to your point, I mean, she's saying the same thing. And Venezuela is a great example of that. She says, hey, they took all the guns there, and we saw what happened in that country thereafter. So let me give you final thoughts, too, as we wrap it up here, because I only have about a moment left. My apologies to everyone on hold. But, Dave, I'll give you the floor.
Okay, one other thing people can read, and this one's free, is I'm co-author of the leading law school textbook on the Second Amendment, and some of those chapters are online and available for free to the public. And in that, the online chapter 14, we discuss exactly what Lucretia was talking about, is how the communist regime in Venezuela first disarmed the public, and then after the public was disarmed, that's when they could impose the full tyranny along with the Cuban secret police who really run the country these days.
Wow.
The website for that is firearmsregulation.com. Firearmsregulation.com. You got five free online chapters, and chapter 14 discusses exactly what happened in Venezuela, and that's the ultimate point of the Second Amendment, is to make sure that can never happen here.
Well, it's so well said. I'm so glad we had this conversation today. Thank you for your time. Always great to talk with you. Keep up your good work, okay?
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me. God bless you and your audience.
God bless you, Dave. And you can follow him at Dave, K-O-P-E-L, at Dave, K-O-P-E-L, and his website, davecoppel.org, that you can follow him there. Always enjoy that conversation. Look, I only have a moment or two left with you today. Just a quick programming note, two things. This Sunday at 3 Central, our Chief Executive Officer, Father Rocky, and I'll be with him this this Sunday to pray the Chapel of Divine Mercy on the Great Feast of Mercy. If you're not familiar with it, the Feast of Mercy is the day that the Lord wanted to proclaim. John Paul II put it on the liturgical calendar in 2000 when he raised St. Faustina to the altars. And St. Faustina was the recipient of these incredible visions of the Lord. And the Lord said, on this day, I want this to be known as the Feast of Mercy. The floodgates of my mercy are open. They are open. And there's some great promises that are associated with this. Tomorrow, I'll explain the extraordinary promise. It's like a plenary indulgence that you get. It's like a new baptism. I'll break it all down for you tomorrow in my program. And you can always call in with your questions. And please do not forget last call, if you will. And I mean last call for the book. And not last call for alcohol, but last call for for Divine Mercy, my book, which we have given away here at the network free. The window is just about closed. After Divine Mercy Sunday, you won't hear me talk about it on the air. Our print run is done. There are only so many books left. If you've not signed up for this, if you want to learn about the Feast of Mercy or the chaplet or the image, if you want to understand God's mercy, if you want to know what Faustina said about the afterlife, her visions of hell, the passion of the Lord, what she said about prayer, there's so much. It's a treasury of information. And I really think it'll help you come to know God, love him, and trust him, and rise above the anxiety and fear that sometimes blocks you in your own life. The way you can get it, and today you should do it, relevantradio.com. I was about to give you my Twitter handle. You do it there too, but relevantradio.com, okay? Relevantradio.com or on the mobile app. Hey, I'm out of time for the day. Kel Clark is coming straight up. I'll be back again tomorrow. Count on my prayers for you. I'd appreciate one too. God bless you.